Chapter 66. An appeal case. As soon as Richard and I had held the conversation, of which I have given an account, Richard communicated the state of his mind to Mr. Jarndyce. I doubt if my guardian were altogether taken by surprise when he received the representation, though it caused him much uneasiness and disappointment. He and Richard were often closeted together, late at night and early in the morning, and passed whole days in London, and had innumerable appointments with Mr. Kench, and labored through a quantity of disagreeable business. While they were thus employed, my guardian, though he underwent considerable inconvenience from the state of the wind, and rubbed his head so constantly that not a single hair upon it ever rested in its right place, was as genial with Ada and me as at any other time, but maintained a steady reserve on these matters. And as our utmost endeavors could only elicit from Richard himself sweeping assurances that everything was going on capitally, and that it really was all right at last, our anxiety was not much relieved by him. We learned, however, as the time went on, that a new application was made to the Lord Chancellor on Richard's behalf as an infant and a ward, and I don't know what, and that there was a quantity of talking, and that the Lord Chancellor described him in open court as a vexatious and capricious infant, and that the matter was adjourned and readjourned, and referred, and reported on, and petitioned about until Richard began to doubt, as he told us, whether, if he entered the army at all, it would not be as a veteran of 70 or 80 years of age. At last an appointment was made for him to see the Lord Chancellor again in his private room, and there the Lord Chancellor very seriously reproved him for trifling with time, and not knowing his mind. A pretty good joke, I think, said Richard, from that quarter. And at last it was settled that his application should be granted. His name was entered at the Horse Guards as an applicant for an ensign's commission. The purchase money was deposited at an agent's, and Richard, in his usual characteristic way, plunged into a violent course of military study, and got up at 5 o'clock every morning to practice the broadsword exercise. Thus, vacation succeeded term, and term succeeded vacation. We sometimes heard of Jarndyce and Jarndyce as being in the paper, or out of the paper, or as being to be mentioned, or as being to be spoken to, and it came on, and it went off. Richard, who was now in a professor's house in London, was able to be with us less frequently than before. My guardian still maintained the same reserve, and so time passed until the commission was obtained, and Richard received directions with it to join a regiment in Ireland. He arrived post-haste with the intelligence one evening, and had a long conference with my guardian. Upwards of an hour lapsed before my guardian put his head into the room, where Ada and I were sitting, and said, "Come in, my dears." We went in and found Richard, whom we had last seen in high spirits, leaning on the chimney-piece looking mortified and angry. "Rick and I, Ada," said Mr. Jarndyce, "are not quite of one mind. Come, come, Rick, put a brighter face upon it." "You are very hard with me, sir," said Richard. "The harder because you have been so considerate to me in all other respects, and have done me kindnesses that I can never acknowledge. I never could have been set right without you, sir." "Well, well," said Mr. Jarndyce. "I want to set you more right yet. I want to set you more right with yourself." "I hope you will excuse my saying, sir," returned Richard in a fiery way, "but yet respectfully, that I think I am the best judge about myself." "I hope you will excuse my saying, my dear Rick," observed Mr. Jarndyce with the sweetest cheerfulness and good humor, "that it's quite natural in you to think so, but I don't think so. I must do my duty, Rick, or you could never care for me in cool blood, and I hope you will always care for me, cool and hot." Ada had turned so pale that he made her sit down in his reading chair and sat beside her. "It's nothing, my dear," he said, "it's nothing. Rick and I have only had a friendly difference, which we must state to you, for you are the theme. Now you are afraid of what's coming." "I am not indeed," Cousin John, replied Otto with a smile, if it is to come from you. Thank you, my dear. Do you give me a minute's calm attention, without looking at Rick? And, little woman, do you likewise? My dear girl, putting his hand on hers as it lay on the side of the easy chair, you recollect the talk we had, before when the little woman told me of a little love affair? It is not likely that either Richard or I can ever forget your kindness that day, Cousin John. I can never forget it, said Richard. And I can never forget it, said Otto. So much the easier what I have to say, and so much the easier for us to agree, returned my guardian, his face irradiated by the gentleness and honor of his heart. Otto, my bird, you should know that Rick has now chosen his profession for the last time. All that he has of certainty will be expended when he is fully equipped. He has exhausted his resources, and is bound henceforward to the tree he has planted. Quite true that I have exhausted my present resources, and I am quite content to know it. But what I have of certainty, sir, said Richard, is not all I have. Rick, Rick, cried my guardian with a sudden terror in his manner, and in an altered voice, and putting up his hands, as if he would have stopped his ears. For the love of God, don't found a hope or expectation on the family curse. Whatever you do on this side the grave, never give one lingering glance towards the horrible phantom that has haunted us so many years. Better to borrow, better to beg, better to die. We were all startled by the fervor of this warning. Richard bit his lip, and held his breath, and glanced at me, as if he felt, and knew that I felt too, how much he needed it. Otto, my dear, said Mr. Jarndyce, recovering his cheerfulness, these are strong words of advice, but I live in Bleak House, and have seen a sight here. Enough of that. All Richard had to start him in the race of life is ventured. I recommend to him and you, for his sake and your own, that he should depart from us with the understanding that there is no sort of contract between you. I must go further. One will be plain with you both. You were to confide freely in me, and I will confide freely in you. I ask you wholly to relinquish, for the present, any tie but your relationship. Better to say at once, sir, returned Richard, that you renounce all confidence in me, and that you advise Otto to do the same. Better to say nothing of the sort, Rick, because I don't mean it. You think I have begun ill, sir, retorted Richard. I have, I know. How I hoped you would begin, and how go on, I told you when we spoke of these things last, said Mr. Jarndyce in a cordial and encouraging manner. You have not made that beginning yet, but there is a time for all things, and yours is not gone by, rather, it is just now fully come. Make a clear beginning altogether. You two, very young, my dears, are cousins. As yet, you are nothing more. What more may come, must come of being worked out, Rick, and no sooner. You are very hard with me, sir, said Richard. Harder than I could have supposed you would be. My dear boy, said Mr. Jarndyce, I am harder with myself when I do anything that gives you pain. You have your remedy in your own hands. Otto, it is better for him that he should be free, and that there should be no youthful engagement between you. Rick, it is better for her, much better, you owe it to her. Come. Each of you will do what is best for the other, if not what is best for yourselves. Why is it best, sir? Returned Richard hastily. It was not when we opened our hearts to you. You did not say so then. I have had experience since. I don't blame you, Rick, but I have had experience since. You mean of me, sir? Well, yes, of both of you, said Mr. Jarndyce kindly. The time has not come for your standing pledged to one another. It is not right, and I must not recognize it. Come, come, my young cousins, begin afresh. Bygones shall be bygones, and a new page turned for you to write your lives in. Richard gave an anxious glance at Otto but said nothing. I have avoided saying one word to either of you or to Esther, said Mr. Jarndyce, until now, in order that we might be open as the day, and all on equal terms. I now affectionately advise, I now most earnestly entreat, you two to part as you came here. Leave all else to time, truth, and steadfastness. If you do otherwise, you will do wrong, and you will have made me do wrong in ever bringing you together. A long silence succeeded. Cousin Richard, said Ada then, raising her blue eyes tenderly to his face, after what our cousin John has said, I think no choice is left us. Your mind may be quite at ease about me, for you will leave me here under his care, and will be sure, that I can have nothing to wish for quite sure, if I guide myself by his advice. I don't doubt, Cousin Richard, said Ada, a little confused, that you are very fond of me, and I don't think you will fall in love with anybody else. But I should like you to consider well about it too, as I should like you to be in all things very happy. You may trust in me, Cousin Richard. I am not at all changeable, but I am not unreasonable, and should never blame you. Even cousins may be sorry to part, and in truth I am very, very sorry, Richard, though I know it's for your welfare. I shall always think of you affectionately, and often talk of you with Esther, and perhaps you will sometimes think a little of me, Cousin Richard. So now, said Ada, going up to him, and giving him her trembling hand, we are only cousins again, Richard for the time perhaps, and I pray for a blessing on my dear cousin, wherever he goes. It was strange to me that Richard should not be able to forgive my guardian for entertaining the very same opinion of him which he himself had expressed of himself in much stronger terms to me. But it was certainly the case. I observed with great regret that from this hour he never was as free and open with Mr. Jarndyce as he had been before. He had every reason given him to be so, but he was not, and solely on his side, an estrangement began to arise between them. In the business of preparation and equipment he soon lost himself, and even his grief at parting from Ada, who remained in Hertfordshire while he, Mr. Jarndyce, and I went up to London for a week. He remembered her by fits and starts, even with bursts of tears, and at such times, would confide to me the heaviest self-reproaches. But in a few minutes he would recklessly conjure up some undefinable means by which they were both to be made rich and happy forever, and would become as gay as possible. It was a busy time, and I trotted about with him all day long, buying a variety of things of which he stood in need. Of the things he would have bought, if he had been left to his own ways, I say nothing. He was perfectly confidential with me, and often talked so sensibly and feelingly about his faults and his vigorous resolutions, and dwelt so much upon the encouragement he derived from these conversations, that I could never have been tired, if I had tried. There used, in that week, to come backward and forward to our lodging to fence with Richard a person who had formerly been a cavalry soldier. He was a fine bluff-looking man, of a frank free bearing, with whom Richard had practiced for some months. I heard so much about him, not only from Richard, but from my guardian too, that I was purposely in the room with my work one morning after breakfast when he came. Good morning, Mr. George, said my guardian, who happened to be alone with me. Mr. Carstone will be here directly. Meanwhile, Miss Summerson is very happy to see you, I know. Sit down. He sat down, a little disconcerted by my presence, I thought, and without looking at me, drew his heavy sunburnt hand across and across his upper lip. You are as punctual as the sun, said Mr. Jarndyce. Military time, sir, he replied. Force of habit. A mere habit in me, sir. I am not at all businesslike. Yet you have a large establishment too, I am told, said Mr. Jarndyce. Not much of a one, sir. I keep a shooting gallery, but not much of a one. And what kind of a shot, and what kind of a swordsman, do you make of Mr. Carstone? Said my guardian. Pretty good, sir, he replied, folding his arms upon his broad chest and looking very large. If Mr. Carstone was to give his full mind to it, he would come out very good. But he don't, I suppose? Said my guardian. He did it first, sir, but not afterwards. Not his full mind. Perhaps he has something else upon it, some young lady, perhaps. His bright dark eyes glanced at me for the first time. He has not me upon his mind, I assure you, Mr. George, said I, laughing, though you seem to suspect me. He reddened a little through his brown, and made me a trooper's bow. No offense, I hope, miss. I am one of the roughs. Not at all, said one. I take it as a compliment. If he had not looked at me before, he looked at me now in three or four quick successive glances. I beg your pardon, sir, he said to my guardian with a manly kind of diffidence, but you did me the honor to mention the young lady's name, Miss Summerson. Miss Summerson, he repeated, and looked at me again. Do you know the name? I asked. No, miss. To my knowledge, I never heard it. I thought I had seen you somewhere. I think not, I returned, raising my head from my work to look at him, and there was something so genuine in his speech and manner. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.